Got your red, white, blue, blind hound farm. Semper Fi tattooed on his left arm. Spent a little more in the store for a tag. And the back it says USA.
Welcome back. Time Smart Talk with Steve-O. You're listening to News Talk WLOB, 1310 AM, Made in America. Please join me in welcoming our guest, Ben Waxman. Ben is co-owner and founder of American Roots, a manufacturing clothing company here in Maine. Welcome, Ben.
Thanks, Steve. Thanks for having us.
It's great, great having you here, and definitely want to get to American Roots and your product line and kind of your philosophy in terms of Made in the U.S., but before we do that, why don't we start a little bit with your background? Where you are you Maine made?
I am. I'm about as Maine made as it gets.
I know.
Yeah.
You've got the vest, the beard. You look like you came right out of a L.L. Bean catalog.
I think in my time in Washington, I reminded myself that I needed to go back to Maine because I never got rid of my beard in all those years in Washington. So and now I was born and raised in Maine. I was born in the Mid Coast. When I was a kid up in Appleton in Camden, Maine, and then was raised in Portland, Maine. Proud Bulldog of Portland High School, and
go Bulldogs!
After that, go Bulldogs! And I went to college and wasn't that hot on college, I should say. I had a real knack for politics and decided to leave college and jump into career in politics for about 17 years, 16 years.
Well, why don't we talk about the political thing? Because I actually have dabbled and have gotten my butt kicked in politics. So is Deb.
Yeah.
And I firmly believe in the answers to not all, but many of our issues lie in civic engagement. You know, people getting more involved, being informed. So talk a little bit about in your early part of your career. You were a senior staff member with the AFL-CIO, the political department. But talk about what kind of your interest in politics in your early part of your career, and then we'll talk about what's going on at American Roots.
Sure. It's ironic. Both politics and manufacturing now were inspired by my mother, Dory Waxman, who instilled in all of her sons that if you wanted to make your community better, you needed to get involved and you needed to give back. And so it started locally, and I was raised in a family where my mother was an elected official with the school board and the city council in Portland, and really just taught us to give back, that if you wanted something to change, whether it was a pothole or more books in a school or better uniforms or better health care or whatever it is, you needed to get involved. You couldn't just talk about it. And when I was 19, I decided to make that jump and got involved in national politics, and then started out most of my career in Maine in my early years, early 20s, working on congressional and gubernatorial races, and then got a great opportunity when I was 23, after about 5 years, 4 years of doing campaigns, to go work for the National AFL-CIO, which is the largest labor federation in the country, represents close to 20 million union members and household members around the country, and really is one of the largest constituencies, I would argue, in American politics today, especially in large states. And I packed my bags after doing a bunch of races here and took a job with the National AFL-CIO and started in Pennsylvania. So they threw me to the wolves and cut my teeth outside of Philadelphia.
Big industrial state where I'm sure there's a lot of involvement, almost near the steel epicenter. Relative to local races, both Deb and I could have used your help a few years ago.
Yes.
From your experience, both as a participant and as somebody who has kind of worked at it a little bit as a vocation, What is the key to break through to the electorate, regardless of ideology or party? And from your background, looking at your background, your orientation looks to be Democrat.
Yep. Absolutely.
You know, labor, pro-labor, you've worked mm-hmm. with labor organization. But regardless of whether you're a Democrat, Republican, or independent, and here in Maine, those three major groups are almost equally divided by thirds. Mm-hmm. My whole position, which I don't know how popular it's been, but I care less about, first of all, I think we need to get more young people informed, educated, and engaged. But I think the answer is shining a light on things and getting people aware as opposed to being tribal and being kind of just partisan for the sake of being partisan. So if a person's a Democrat, Republican, Independent, Green, Libertarian, whatever they are, I just want people to be engaged and know the issues and then make informed decisions. But as a former paid political operative and as a person who's engaged in the process, what do you think we need to do? Here in Maine, I think, we, you know, with 1.3 million people approximately in the population, we have about 917,412 registered voters. I just want more people to know the issues. Sure. Any thought on that in Maine or any thought on the political landscape?
Yeah, you know, I always say politics in America, if you look at it from a pure, you know, what gauges success and what have you, I always think it's time, place, and circumstance being one of the greatest things. And while I am a registered Democrat, I call myself an American first and a Democrat second, if that makes sense, because I certainly disagree with many things within the party that I'm registered to. And I also believe that it's time for Democrats and Republicans and independents to sit down and actually look at what does America need and how do we actually work together. And that comes down to personal relationships and respecting people, respecting individuals' views on the world. There's too much personal animosity towards other individuals or their beliefs. And I think we're in a really dangerous place in America where if you don't agree with me, then you're not a good person, which is like the most opposite thing of our founding fathers that it could possibly be. So my attitude is, as far as Mainers, you know, that's kind of why I wanted to do American Roots, and it leads to that, is that we can make great change in our own communities by sitting down and saying, what do our communities need? Are our taxes too high? Or do our schools need to be improved? Are our rivers protected? What is our economic plan? You know, at the end of the day, politics, like anything in our country, the foundation is economics. If your economics aren't in place and there's not a job for Mike Smith to go to or Sonia or a new immigrant or a lifelong Mainer to actually put food on the table, work a 40-hour work week and retire with dignity, then we're losing sight of the big picture and we're unable to do all those other things. When it comes to the social issues, I think everybody's entitled to their own social opinion. That's never going to change. But there are core fundamental things that we can sit down as Mainers and as Americans and say, listen, we all want our kids to go to better schools. How do we fix that?
Yeah, we all want to have healthy kids. We all want education. Yeah. We all, you know, at some level care about the environment because
absolutely.
That's where we're living. Mm-hmm. We have Ben Waxman here. He's co-owner of American Roots, recently formed company here in Maine, which we'll talk about in just one sec. From your experience working with the AFL-CIO, the largest union or organized union, mm-hmm. and also it's part of, from looking at your website, it's kind of part of the ethos of American Roots mm-hmm. to be union made or to be a leader in American made, union made. Talk a little bit the idea of unions in today's America or today's Maine, both from their origin, where I think many people would agree that there was a real necessity to have organized labor, whether it was from coal mines or whether it was during the Industrial Revolution when working conditions were horrible, and unions played a vital role in terms of literally life and welfare and safety for employees. And now we're in the year 2016 where some of those dimensions still exist, but many people would argue on the other side that unions are clinging to an old paradigm, and that now it's mostly leverage against ownership relative to, and many people look back in the auto industry, I think back in the 80s and 90s, which was part of what would be considered part of the collapse, you would have people putting hubcaps on cars making $80,000 a year. There are people right now, longshoremen in Southern California, and there's always a longshoreman strike every couple of years. Some of those guys are making $100,000 a year working on the docks in Southern California, and maybe that's the market price, or maybe it's artificially the market price. But what's your you work directly for the AFL-CIO, so you have an experience in that perspective. And then let's talk about American roots and how you think union labor and American made is critical to the ethos of your company now.
Sure. You know, the AFL-CIO is a federation. It represents 57 international unions that represent the needs of, like I said, close to 20 million members in their households across the country. There's the extreme version of, and the reality that I think people that say, well, why do you need unions today? You know, you needed them during the turn of the century. You needed them. There's a program that just came out called The Men Who Built America. It was on the History Channel. I don't know if you've seen it. But it talks about, the auto industry and the steel industry and horrible conditions.
The railroad industry back in the 1880s.
I mean, the Vanderbilts. I mean, you go into the Vanderbilt, Ford, this and that, those eras, you're there. If someone was to say to me, and one of my best friends who's not necessarily pro-union but not anti-union, who owns a manufacturing company in Southern California, said to me, we pay our workers great wages, we pay them health care, we give them a 401k, and they get ownership in the company. Why would I need a union? And I say to that, well, it's not whether or not you need a union. It's whether or not a worker needs a voice. And that's what – I remember having this conversation with my fiance, Whitney Reynolds, who's not here, and my business partner, along with my mother, Dory Waxman. And I said to Whitney, you know, why are you so passionate about a union? I said it's because too often – there are situations that I would argue are happening across our country and across the globe where a worker is unable to voice their opinion out of fear. Whether the conditions are good, whether the wages are good, whether this or that, they're unable to voice their opinion because of fear of retaliation or fear of job loss, fear of wage loss, fear of benefit loss. And so when a worker is able to have a union, and by the way, our workers chose, they met with over close to 8 unions, and they chose the United Steelworkers of America, who also represent paper and textile. They chose a union, and they actually asked us, our workers asked us, why do we need a union? You're good people. You're paying us good wages.
Was it driven by you, or was it organically driven by the employees? Because you have such your background, your personal background, is so rooted in union.
Right.
Did you influence the structure?
No, I didn't influence. I didn't influence which union they chose, because that would be.
But did you influence the idea that your employees, like, hey, you guys may want to consider a union. It's up to you to pick which union that represents your interest and your best voice. Mm-hmm. But how did that work?
It was interesting. It was in my belief. I said that if we're going to start a manufacturing company, when I sat down with my mother, Dory Waxman, who's been in textiles many times and is my mentor and hero on many levels, and Whitney Reynolds, I said, our shop's going to be union because it's what I believe in, and I don't want people to say that just because it's 2015, we don't need unions anymore. I want them to be seen as the solution to our economic, what I like to call plateau in America right now, where the middle class are unable to retire with dignity at the rate they were able to retire with dignity in 1960. If you look at the peak of organized labor, when it was, you know, the average union household, 35% of America was unionized. That was also the highest median household income for middle class in the history of the United States in 1960. I mean, that was unprecedented. It was a different time. the world was different, but it proved that there was a checks and balances. It's almost like, I kind of use the example that if workers are able to have a union, it keeps the ownership in check. Just like if the if there wasn't a union, who's going to hold the owners accountable when they're making mistakes or getting ahead of themselves in regards to the direction of the company? Even though I'm an owner, I'm going to drive the direction of the company. If we're not putting back in the pot for the people that are actually making the fleece vest that I'm wearing right now,
right,
what good am I? And I also believe that it also empowers people. It makes them feel proud. And when I invited organized labor to come into our shop, because I was very vocal about it, I said, the door's open and there's a 2-month window, exactly 2 months, for unions to come in and meet with our workers. People were blown away by that, but I just felt like it was the right thing to do because I wanted those workers to have a voice. I wanted them to feel like, wow, if they have an issue that is disagreeing with us as owners, they have someone they can talk to about it. Because if you're a worker and you come to a non-union shop, and I've been to plenty of non-union shops, and your machine's not running right or your chair's not right, and I'm having a bad day as the owner, and I don't want to replace that chair, I'm not going to replace the chair. And if you're a worker, you should have the right to sit in a chair that actually is comfortable if you're going to sit there for 8 hours a day and be paid a subpar living wage. And so for me, it's a simple principle that a worker should have a voice at the workplace. And you know what? We're a great employer. We'd be a great employer whether we had a union or not. But it's about sending a message to everyone else. The purpose of it is it gives workers a voice. It gives them a place of self-worth. And it also creates a sense of community within the workplace that actually helps your product. And, you know, I go to the auto industry. Everybody can blame, you know, American cars weren't great. The guy on the assembly line, he didn't design the car. The engineers designed the car. I drive a Ford Explorer. I love it. It's not the guy who's making $75,000 a year in Detroit's fault that the transmission went out in some truck. It's the engineer who designed it. And that's where there is that skew. And my argument about they making $100,000 a year, to me, if you're working 60 hours a week with your hands, physical labor, and you've put your time in and the company's doing well, why shouldn't you make $100,000 a year? You know, somebody said, are you going to do, when you started your company from the textile standpoint, they said, are you going to do piecework or hourly wage? I said, hourly wage. I said, you ever been to a piecework factory? You sit in a chair and you don't get up because you know you've got to make X amount of pieces to hit your wage. That to me is an abuse of power. And that's really what it comes down to. And so I think if somebody had to say, why do you have a union if you're a good employer? I'd say it gives the workers a sense of community. It gives them a voice when they need a voice. And above all, it holds us in check too as owners. And, you know, the whole issue of like labor and management and not getting along. Yeah, I have an extensive background in labor. I'm able to sit down with organized labor. We're in, I said to the union once our workers chose it, I said, there'll never be a negotiation here. This is a partnership. And when I said that to the district director of the Steelworkers Union after our workers chose their union, he said, I wish every owner said that to us because we would love to see our company succeed. That where we represent workers. And I think that there's, hopefully there's some change in that. And you know what? There's a lot of great employers out there where there's not a union, and I respect them. I'm not looking down on any of those folks. They're all good folks.
We have Ben Waxman here. He is a former, very involved, as you could probably tell, in organized labor with the AFL-CIO. He is currently with his partners, his mom, Dory Waxman, and Whitney Reynolds, founded American Roots, and their website is AmericanRootsWear.com, based here in Portland. We'll talk about that in a sec. But to just follow up briefly on the union and the labor discussion, and I support organized labor for many of the reasons that you just mentioned, But I also recognize that there's a counter argument and a counterweight that when you talk about labor having a voice, the presumption, it sounded like with your argument, that the voice is always one of righteousness or righteous issues. Many times in labor's history, that the voice has been overreaching, or it's used organized labor tactics, which the biggest and the most powerful lever is work stoppages and strikes. And what's the internal check and balance with organized labor to say, you know, it's great if it's a partnership, but when you get to a certain critical mass with a company and you can literally stop the company, in some ways you can hold the company hostage to what could be an unreasonable demand. Somebody could say that, you know, in order for us to be competitive, we need $20 an hour labor. The labor itself say, no, we really want $40 an hour. We want these other things. What about the counterargument that suggests organized labor isn't always coming from the most righteous position? There's a natural tendency for humans, or many people, to seek kind of their own best interest or their, sure. Or the most advantage. And where's the counterweight there? Because I think that's what frustrates a lot of people, is the sense that it isn't always righteous. Sometimes it is exploitive, and sometimes it overplays the hand. Well, we're not doing this unless we get this.
Sure. You know, it's a great question. The there's a study that I often referenced when I would speak on behalf of the Federation in panel formats, whether it was a member of the Chamber of Commerce somewhere in the middle of Ohio or somewhere in Pennsylvania, a thing called Common Sense Economics. And my my old boss and mentor, Rich Trumka, who's the national president of the AFL-CIO, taught me a lot about. And in that presentation around Common Sense Economics, it talks about, if you look at, and I'm going to get my years wrong here, I think it was 1975, the average rate of pay of a CEO to the average worker of that company was 100 times that of the worker per hour, which in theory, if you're the CEO of a company and you're making 100 times that of your worker, okay, this is a capitalist society and that's the way the world works. That was in like 1975, and I could be off on that, Steve, the year. It was sometime in the 70s when the study was conducted. In 2004, and I could be off on this year, it's either 2004 or 2005, that was 900 times that, the CEO's average pay to the average worker. And so I think that there was a gap that happened. Something happened in our country where management pushed, labor pushed, and somehow the ability for the righteous issues to be pushed aside and for the greed issues or the over, as you said, overreaching issues came to the forefront. I think it began out of one of the principles that said to us at American Roots why we can do the company, which is profit over greed. And for us, we're able to make a profit without being greedy. And I think that that's a message that we'll always stand by. I make no qualms about it. Do I want to put my kids through college? Do I want to own a lake house on Sebago Lake? Absolutely. Do I want to live in a nice house in Portland, Maine and grow old? Absolutely. But do I want to do it at the expense of workers who are working at our company and not have them have the ability to live a good life? No, absolutely not. So I think the counterargument to what you're saying is, I think that there's mistakes made by many, but I think at the end of the day, it comes down to profit over greed or greed over profit. And that's where the breakdown in our country really began, I think, shortly after the 1960s.
Interesting. We have Ben Waxman here. You're listening to Tide Smart Talk with Steve-O, News Talk Radio, WLOB, 1310 a.m. Let's talk about the company. Yeah, you started in, is it in 2015, working with your mom, who's been very active in politics and civics in both Portland and Southern Maine, Dory Waxman, and also your fiance, Whitney Reynolds. Where did the idea specifically come from starting a business in would you call it, just outward apparel, active apparel, fleece, outerwear.
Yeah, yeah.
So of all the, you know, you've, your political background, your manufacturing, labor, AFL-CIO, somehow you landed on wearables as a business path. Where did that idea specifically come from? And then let's talk about what exactly is American Roots and talk about the business a little bit.
Sure. So when I first told a former colleague of mine, I'm going to start a textile company with my wife-to-be and be the sister company to my mother's current company, Old Port Woolen Textile, he said, "Are you nuts?" He said, "Are you out of your mind?" I said, "Probably," but it started with a and actually a friend of mine gave me a gift. He gave me a fleece vest, and it was embroidered on the left panel with a logo of a company that he represented. He was an attorney in Boston. This was last winter. And the inside of the jacket, it said, made with USA fabrics in big letters. And in little letters, it said assembled in a different country.
Right.
And I originally talked to my mother about starting a blanket business to because there's a growing demand for Buy American in the U.S. And I thought to myself, wait a second. They make Polar Tech fleece in the U.S. They make it in Massachusetts. They make it in Tennessee. They make it in New Hampshire. Why can't we make a fleece vest, a fleece jacket, a fleece pullover, a blanket, a hat, scarf, you name it, 100% in the United States, make it in Portland, Maine, and market it to American companies, American institutions, colleges, universities, sports teams, unions, political organizations, you name it. And our marketing message would be, you can buy your outerwear from us and be guaranteed that down to the thread, the label, the pocket fabric, the zipper, to the actual fabric is 100% from U.S. soil. And that, to me, seemed like a novel idea. So I picked up the phone and I called 25 private sector companies. I called 25 union and political friends. And I said, if I could do this, would you buy? And the response by both the private sector and the public sector, business, labor, politics, you name it, they said, well, when can we order? And I sat down with my mother and I said, need your help. And she has a small facility, which we have completely outgrown, and are happy to announce American Roots will be moving to a new factory of over 5,000 square feet in Portland in April. But I said to my mom, this is the concept. She liked it, and we teamed up with some great organizations like Goodwill Industries, CEI, Portland Adult Ed, the Department of Labor. A couple other organizations have been absolutely critical, and I really want to praise Portland Adult Ed, CEI, and Goodwill Industries for all the work they've done through my mom, Dory Waxman, and Whitney, my partner. They've allowed us to go out and actually train a workforce because we needed to train people.
Right.
We needed a training program. Nobody knows how to sew anymore, certainly in the Portland area, at the level we needed to be at. Maine's a rich tradition, like most of New England, of textiles. But like we all know, we watched those factories close down. Certainly when I was a kid, and I saw it firsthand, and I saw it later on in the steel industry and the auto industry in the Midwest when I was working for the AFL-CIO, and I thought to myself, we're going to make something that's 100% American-made, and we're going to give it a go. And that was 14 months ago, and I'm happy to say that 14 months later, we've outgrown our space. We have two shifts. We have a second shift training program, a daytime work shift, and we're taking orders into the month of June at this point, and we're moving to a new 5,000-square-foot factory in Portland in April.
That's great. Does your mom, Dory Waxman, and your fiance, Whitney, they ever overvote you? Do they ever just gang up?
Two strong
women.
I'm
familiar with your mom, but I'm guessing your fiance is equally strong. And so that has to be a fun dynamic.
She is. You know, my mom has been a great mentor, and she's enjoying being a grandmother, but also enjoys mentoring Whitney and I. And Whitney is my ultimate soulmate on many levels because of how tough she is. But she is as passionate as I am, And, you know, the joke amongst my friends is Ben drives a Ford Explorer and Whitney drives a Harley Davidson. So, and that's the truth. So she is tough. But I, you know, I'm the only guy on the, in the factory. There's 13 women. So I've learned a lot about my previous environment, which was not always the case. There was a lot of men in that environment and women. But this day and age in my daily routine, I get there at 6:30 a.m. and leave at 9 o'clock at night. And I learn something new every day from all of them.
That's great. Talk a little bit about the product itself. And
sure.
You know, I mentioned the website, AmericanRootsWear.com. Mm-hmm. But where does the product line currently stand?
Sure.
Where is your distribution, whether it's through retail or online? Mm-hmm. And so for any of our listeners that are interested in kind of the ethos and kind of the backstory, where can they actually connect with the product? And who is the who's the target consumer for American Roots product?
Sure. Well, you can check us out on our webpage at www.AmericanRootsWear.com. But we have a two-track business model, and we started with a very basic product line. We have a vest, a jacket, which are 200-weight Polartec fleece, and we have a fleece quarter-zip pullover, which is a 100-weight fleece, and then we have a blanket, a hat, and a scarf, which are all 200-weight.
What does 200 weight mean relative to what's typical in the marketplace?
Sure.
The density of the fleece, and what would the average person see or feel when they were comparing your product to what they may be more familiar out there on the street right now?
Most of the fleece vests you see in Maine or anywhere else in America are 200 weight, pretty standard. It's like it feels a little thick, but it's not too thick. You can wear it under a jacket. A 100 weight is a classic pullover that you could wear underneath a vest or underneath a jacket or underneath a sports coat. It really comes down to warmth. The 200-weight jacket is actually a really warm jacket. You know, you can wear it on a not-so-cold winter day. It's a great fall and spring jacket. The track model that we have is business-to-business. So a lot of our clients right now, we have, you know, everything from small construction companies to Narragansett Beer Company out of Rhode Island has signed on with us. A bunch of different folks have really stepped up. I'm actually in discussions with my good friend Fred Forsley at Shipyard and other folks in the local area from the private sector. But we also have a retail side, which we hope to expand. We'll be rolling out a hoodie, as we like to call it, a hooded sweatshirt.
There's some company out in San Francisco, I don't know if you're familiar with it, but they created a few years ago the ultimate
American Giant.
Yeah, American Giant.
They're awesome.
And they're supposed to be like a 2-month wait.
Yeah.
Because, and I don't believe it's fleece, it's a cotton material.
Yeah, it's cotton.
But it's a super heavy, and it is the holy grail of sweatshirts, right?
It's awesome.
Yeah.
It's awesome.
But different product category. You're focusing on fleece, and they're more of a heavy cotton thing.
Yeah.
But that company has created a brand that it has kind of a distinctive brand profile.
Yeah.
And people wait for months to get their American Giant hoodie sweatshirt.
I commend those guys. I read all about their business model. You know, American Roots right now, we're not reinventing the wheel on the product we're selling. We hope to expand as we grow into the more retail millennial generation. We've got a great designer, Luciana Reale, from she's actually local. She's from South Portland, Maine, but studied at Fashion Institute of Technology in Italy. And we're looking at, you know, years 2 and 3, rolling out some different types of designs and products. But that company that's on San Francisco, American Giant, you know, it's kind of like us. If somebody had to ask us what our company about, we're 100% American made. We guarantee our product. It's going to be something you want to wear. It's not going to be boxy and uncomfortable. It's going to be something you like.
And what about retail? Is that both currently and in the future? What are the plans, and what has been your success right now getting into stores?
We retail right now. All of our retail is, you know, all e-commerce online. We have, primarily because we're building our workforce, we've actually all the orders we are sold on capacity. That's why we're adding to expand our capacity in the second quarter of this year. is the retail thing. We got a lot of orders before Christmas, but we're really focused on the B2B, which is direct sales calls that I do. I have a sales trip next week to California with a number of different startups in the IT tech world that are interested in buying our product for their companies. So we're focused on that.
Have you heard of the Magic Show out in Las Vegas?
I have
it's
not.
It's a big clothing...
I have heard of this. Yeah.
And it's kind of, it's like what CES, which many people have heard of, a Consumer Electronics Show, which just happened a couple of weeks ago. Magic is similar to fashion, that type of thing. So for a lot of your audience, your business target, it's people and companies that share kind of the American-made sense, and that's part of maybe their business story, and then that relates to not only having great products that you have, but also really the DNA being American-made or union-made or something like that.
It's interesting, so that a friend of mine, Noah Flaherty, who I grew up with, grew up in Kennebunk, he runs a marina in Massachusetts, and they ordered, I believe it was 30 vests prior to Christmas for all their employees. We embroidered Brewer Marina in the North Shore in Massachusetts, above Boston. And I asked Noah a week ago, I said, you know, how did it go when you passed out the vests? He goes, you know, I told the story about the company, because we have, everybody asked about the hang tags, 100% sure. American made. And when I gave the people the vests the first time, and they were like, thanks, this is great, I like it. And then they heard about the story, they liked it even more because it was a great product and they loved the story. And so we're working with a couple different folks who are friends of ours on the public relations side and marketing side, including my dad, who's been Dan Waxman, who's been a great mentor to me on marketing stuff, is how do we take our story?
We all love a story.
Yeah.
And Jerry's ice cream would be another fattening ice cream if it wasn't for Ben and Jerry, the hills of Vermont.
Right.
The cows are happy.
Exactly.
The little cemetery for the flavors that rotate out. You create a mythology when you combine an effective mythology with the intrinsic product value, which you've talked about, then that's, I think, one of the things that really kind of powers brands to the top.
Yeah. No, and that's what we're learning as we go. We've learned the hard way on some things. We've definitely... We hit the sales button on October 22nd and kind of took a deep breath on November 4th and said, well, we got the right idea.
I'm asking for a friend, but do you have anything in the 2X size?
Absolutely.
Really?
We go all the way up to 4X. We just did a 4X. We had an order, significant order for 4X vests. So we're actually adjusting a pattern because we went up to 3X, but we're throwing it at a 4X.
That's a, what would be that? I was thinking, what's the Japanese sumo wrestling team?
Yes.
Like who would order the all the 4Xs? Probably a sumo wrestling team. Yeah. They want to all dress alike.
Yeah, I'd like to meet the person just to challenge us because, but no, we, you know, and eventually, you know, Steve, we want to get into the, I have a brother who is an All-American athlete who's 6'5", and, you know, he loves our product, but he says, can you do tall? You know, so that's a whole other thing, and we're learning as we go.
But how do you actually do that? I mean, you work with designers, because the interesting thing, I think we all take apparel for granted because it's become so formulaic, for the big companies at least, where you put on a shirt, a pair of pants, and you just kind of assume that it's an easy, to engineer a shirt or a pair of pants, or in your case, vests or outerwear, it's kind of an easy thing. But there's a lot of detail and there's a lot of like math that goes into it and coming up with templates, because, you know, there's multiple dimensions of, you know, size and curvature, and how do you even start when you're building a company and saying, this is what the large American Roots vest will look like, this is how big the opening. Or is it kind of standardized in the industry where you use some other template and then you just put your American-made product, you know, through the process of using that template?
That's a great question. Somebody said to me, a reporter from ABC said, how would you compare building this business to running, you know, a presidential race or any of that stuff? I said that was a cakewalk. There's literally 17 parts, 17 steps that go into this vest alone.
So you have a zipper manufacturer. Presumably you don't manufacture your own zipper. So there's a company out there, something zipper.
Yep.
You need to make sure that's American made to make sure it's authentic.
It took us 5 months to find this pocket fabric, to find pocket fabric that you could sew with Polar Tech fleece that was made in the United States. And so the to answer your question about that, it took the process for our prototypes and fittings and adjustments was about a 7 month process from start to finish. We went through four different designers. We finally settled on a great designer who we're happy with right now, Luciana, who's doing a great job. She's actually also our instructor for our training class. We brought her on to do that as well. So it's kind of been a great fit. But, you know.
Great fit. That's got to be an apparel pun, right? It was a great fit.
Great fit. That's right. But it's definitely the amount of work and detail that goes into making just a fleece pullover.
Right.
It was new to me. You know, I'm like, oh, this can't be that hard. But let me tell you something. You know, I cut with Whitney. We do a lot of the cutting for the actual patterns after we roll. We roll on a giant table with a spreader. And that fleece moves. It's not like wool, you know, it moves. And so the top layer might move from the bottom layer a quarter of a centimeter.
So there's some elasticity, right?
Mm-hmm.
And
absolutely.
So you've got to account. You can cut something that feels like it's completely lined up, and one piece may be stretched a little more than another piece.
Yep. Exactly.
And you and Whitney never fight about that?
Never.
Absolutely. Never.
Never. Absolutely.
We're going to do another show on relationship advice with Ben Waxman because he and one of his co-owners, his fiance, Whitney Reynolds, never fight, neither with your mom. Your mom's been a consultant and a partner, and she never reverts back to mom and says, Ben, what are you doing?
This was the hardest thing I think any of us ever possibly imagined because a lot of bumps, you fight, you bruise, you bleed, you sweat, you cry, you do all those things. That's all very real.
Right.
And you have a lot of strong personalities, but at the end of the day, we all respect each other. And, you know, there's a lot of love in the family. So that's a good thing.
That's great. We have Ben Waxman here. He's co-owner of American Roots. Their website is AmericanRootsWear.com, based here in Portland. Kind of a distinct business model in that right from the start, Ben has had a deep background both in politics and in union politics and representation, and he started his business with interest and intent to make sure that it was pro-labor and pro-union. Deb, I want to get your thoughts on that in terms of, as a consumer, same thing with you, Sully, in there. We've got Deb representing. Which group are you part of? Are you boomer or what?
I'm boomer.
You're a boomer. Then we've got Sully here. She's kind of millennial, right?
Well, kind of millennial.
By the way, they just announced the new generation who are teenagers now.
Oh,
so for my kids, Cammie and Zach, they're calling it the Z generation.
I've heard that, yes.
Really?
Yeah.
Yes.
So I just read a report saying that if you're in consumer marketing, you want to gear up your approach because anyone in the Z generation has grown up with technology,
right.
And they don't know a world without the internet. So it's a whole different mindset.
That's true.
So Deb, for you in the
boomer, in the
upper edge of the boomer,
lower edge, the very top,
very very top, and also for you, Sally, what does that component aside from and I'm looking at the product right now that Ben is wearing. Looks like great fleece product, and they've got great reviews online. But what about the union made in the U.S., made in America? Does that message resonate with you guys, and how so?
It does with me. I mean, I grew up, go America. Everything American made when I was young was the best in the world. Now, as I've gotten older, it hasn't been true, but I think a lot of the manufacturing that's coming back to the state of Maine especially – they're really pumping out some quality stuff. So I'm really looking forward to purchasing.
Thank you.
But can I ask you before I want to get Sully's view on this too. But you are I don't want to say dyed in the wool because that's another apparel pun. But you are very...
only allowed one per show.
One per show. You are very conservative.
Yes.
In your view. I can never tell if that's right, left, elephant, donkey, whatever. I don't know, blue, red, but you're Republican, you're conservative.
Yeah.
And how does the message of Made in America, which is kind of a patriotic message, jibe with the pro-union, pro-labor? Does that conflict at all with your kind of core views?
I don't even consider the union part of it at all. I consider them irrelevant mostly now with millennials coming up, freely speaking in the workplace and freely being more often being heard. Yeah. And their concerns being addressed. So I don't even think about that aspect, but if it's Made in America, I'm all about it.
Great. How about you, Sally? What do you think there?
I think for the most part, I agree with Deb. I think with my generation, and I know you kind of peg me as a hipster sometimes, but
she's so
in
hip.
My opinion, it's important to be American made, to have pride in what you purchase and what you wear and the thing, especially the things that are made in your hometown or your home state. But I think for my generation, it's tough, too, because we have to find this balance between things we're proud of and things we can afford, where everyone my age is carrying around a couple $10,000 of debt. We have to find things that we can also afford to represent.
Yeah, that's a challenge. I had kind of an interesting epiphany or experience a couple months ago. I went to China and spent some time in Shenzhen, China, which there is a section of that city, which is on the other side of the world, called Foxconn. And they have, I think, about 300,000 high-tech workers. And that is where most of the Apple products and certainly iPhones are assembled. So if you look in the back of an iPhone, it'll basically say designed or engineered in the U.S. because they want to get that in there. And then they put assembled in China.
Right.
And so this place, Foxconn, is like the largest college campus, only it's not as tranquil as it looks. It's super industrial. We drove by the outside. There's dorms and 300,000 people. An incredibly high percentage of suicides. There was a report last year where in 1 month, I think 10 workers committed suicide, and they're all doing different, this isn't just Apple, but they're doing tech assembly and tech work for a lot of tech companies, and these massive interconnected factories the size of 20 football fields. But it's a tough issue. And, you know, the issue in Apple, where in some ways they're doing some very progressive things, they're super innovative. They've broken through three or four different industries, from computers to music to movies. But at the same time, the consumer has this insatiable appetite for new technology, but they only want to pay a certain amount. And it was really kind of a conflicting thing. You know, myself, I have an iPhone, but then you see the work conditions. But, you know, I think there has to be a bigger political discussion here in the country relative to, you know, we all want, and to Sally's point, for a lot of people shopping at Walmart, it's a question of if you have $100 a week that you have to stretch for food or for your basic goods and services, you can get a lot more stuff at Walmart. And for many people, it becomes a simple equation of I'd like to do the right thing or I'd like to support American workers, but I've got to get through the week. And I don't know how that cycle ends. Like anything else, I think it starts with good political policy.
Yeah.
I think there are policy issues in terms of taxes and offshore money, and Apple has billions of dollars now parked around the world because of our tax policies here. But it's so complex. But, you know, what do you think about that, Ben?
Well, the economy's not like the weather, you know. You can set trade policy to help workers and help the person that wants to buy American who only has $100. That's up to the people in Washington. That's up to the American voter. I don't care if you're a Democrat or Republican or an independent or a Green or Libertarian. It's about being American. We have a choice as a country. Do we want to continue to allow certain institutions and companies to not pay their fair share because they're making a choice of greed over profit by manufacturing somewhere else where the cost of labor is lower, there's no benefits, the EPA, there's no EPA, there's this, there's that. And even some of those companies that, like an Apple or whoever, say, well, we're abiding by environmental laws. Well, okay, you can't just pick one that you want to be good at. You got to do them all. And I think that's what it really comes down to. You can't blame an American who only has $100 a week where they're going to spend that. American Roots' product, our goal, our pricing is literally competitive to that of our competitors. It's dollars and cents, not by much. So it's not like you can't be done and make a profit. So I think that it really comes down to the American people making a choice, being advocates to their elected officials and saying, you know what, we need to change the way that we import things and the way we export things. We can't change what happens in China, but we can change what happens in America. And that comes down to legislation.
Well said, Ben Waxman, co-owner of American Roots. In the last couple of minutes, what's the future? You mentioned in April you're moving to a new manufacturing location. Mm-hmm. Where do you see the company over the next 5 years? And, you know, relative to expansion or product line, where would you like to see American Roots go?
You know, in year one, our goal was to have 5 pieces of product. We're probably going to end around 7 pieces. We thought we would end year one with 8 team members, 8 employees. We're probably going to end closer to 15. In years 3, 4, and 5, we kind of jump expansion because we really focus on our direct retail targeting to the millennial generation. We found that when we do talk to a young professional who's 27 years old and lives in Boston, Massachusetts, if it's a really cool piece of clothing and they know where it's made and how it's made and it's made in the U.S. and it's not made in a sweatshop, they'll pay an extra couple bucks to pay for it. We'll look to broaden our ability to do business to business across sectors, so both the private sector and public sector. And, you know, as we grow, we're constantly training. We're working with our partners like CEI, who've been great, Goodwill Industries and Portland Adult Ed, to grow our workforce. And as our workforce grows, our business will grow. You know, my dream is that the incredible people that work for us now, that they get to 20 years from now retire from our company. That would be, I know that we've hit the home run on that one.
Well, that's great. Well, we've run out of time. I'd love to have you come back sometime.
Absolutely.
Wish you the best of luck going forward.
Thanks so much, Steve, for having us. And check us out.
Yeah, and good luck to you and your partners, your mom, Dory Waxman, and your fiance, Whitney Reynolds, and all of your associates at American Roots. For listeners, you can go to AmericanRootsWear.com, get information. They would be happy to made to order. And something in the 2X tall, kind of a floral kind of thing, I would love to kind of put in order. So
of course you would.
Yeah, I'm going to go to my computer and put in order. Thanks for being here, Ben.
Great. Thank you, Steve.
You've been listening to Tide Smart Talk with Steve on News Talk WLOB, 1310 a.m. We'll be back next week. Thank you.